This is the tax update for June 2nd, 2008. This week, poor records not equated to fraud. Tax Update podcast intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the position presented. The podcast and the supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use includes using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information that tax practitioners have subscribed to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Well, this podcast is being recorded very shortly after I've recorded the one I released previously, the one just before this last week. And it's being recorded this time because I'm going to be heading to New Orleans for a meeting with the AICPA Tax Division on June 2nd. And I mention that mainly because while we're delaying this release so it comes out in a relatively timely fashion about the order you expect these to come out, if there's been a major development in the coming week that I seem to be ignoring in favor of this case, realize that's likely because I don't have time to put one out in the interim. And therefore, we'll probably be covering that other development. For instance, if the IRS were to release the regulations on the preparer penalty this week, we probably would have to delay that discussion until I get back from New Orleans. So that's why we're discussing this case this week. But this week, we're going to look at a Court of Federal Claims case that can be very instructional both on how the civil fraud penalty applies in a tax case and some of the real issues that can arise and some of the dangers that can arise when you're representing a client in an examination before the IRS, especially when you start getting into these areas like the civil fraud penalty and some of the problems and issues that a representative can run into. This particular case is going to be instructive because this case was a case of Dr. Gagliardi, which is Gagliardi versus the United States, 2008 TNT 9820. Now, he was a dentist who didn't really practice the most thorough of internal controls over his business receipts. And this lack of control resulted when he switched over to using a bookkeeper to keep track of his books instead of letting his outside CPA kind of summarize everything at the end of the year based upon what he gave him, to a significant chunk of income being missed and falling between the cracks and not being reported on his tax return. Now, that situation was bad enough, but it became worse when the IRS agent proposed to assess a civil fraud penalty. And then on top of that, the taxpayer's representative, the CPA who previously had kept the books, signed off on and agreed to the assessment of the civil fraud penalty when acting under the power of attorney that he had and signed the documents on behalf of the taxpayer. Now, the Gagliardis were not happy with that result, and they filed their administrative claim for refund that the IRS turned down and then filed suit in the Court of Federal Claims to recover the about $17,000 in penalties they had paid on the assessment on tax. Their story is this week's podcast. Now, the Internal Revenue Code provides a number of penalties that can be applied to taxpayers for an underpayment of tax, and one of the most onerous is the civil fraud penalty under Section 6663. That section provides an A that if any part of the underpayment of tax required to be shown the return is due to fraud, there shall be added to the tax an amount equal to 75% of the portion of the underpayment which is attributable to fraud. Well, that's bad enough, but B tells us that the presumption becomes once we show any of the underpayment is due to fraud, all of the underpayment is presumptively due to fraud unless the taxpayer can establish otherwise. B tells us that if the secretary establishes any portion of underpayment is attributable to fraud, the entire underpayment shall be treated as attributable to fraud, except with respect to any portion of underpayment which the taxpayer establishes by a preponderance of the evidence is not attributable to fraud. Finally, we close out with 6663C. That section provides that the spouse will only be covered on a joint return. Each spouse is only covered to the extent that we can show there is fraud attributable to that spouse. So essentially, if your spouse commits fraud and you don't, the fraud won't be applied on your underpayment, but will be applied on the spouse's underpayment. Now note, the penalty itself is 75%. And as we noted, it presumptively, the penalty applies to all the underpayment involved on the return. Now, while this is not a criminal penalty, it obviously would often arise in a civil portion of a criminal tax case where there was criminal fraud involved. There's probably civil fraud involved. And such in a case where the IRS begins discussing the civil fraud penalty would certainly seem to be in danger of coming up with a referral to a criminal case. If it appears to be serious enough that we have a civil case in mind, there may be a criminal problem in play because the fraud is a fairly significant issue. And obviously, tax fraud is a criminal matter. And fraud does involve an intentional understatement of the tax. Again, that begins to look close to the criminal mind, criminal area, which is one of those areas that obviously gets us very nervous when this is brought up. Now, this is a penalty that we don't often deal with because more often we see the negligence penalties. Those are smaller penalties, and they generally provide for in negligence. The issue is not so much that the taxpayer knowingly tried to evade tax or reduce tax or knowingly did something bad, but simply did through incompetence. Did not properly report the amount of tax or didn't take the right steps or didn't do the right work to determine what the proper result should be. And in that case, then we get negligence penalties, not fraud. Fraud involves intentional understatement of the tax. Now let's go on to the case of the missing dental deposits or the Gagliardi case. Now, Dr. Gagliardi had three locations that year in New Jersey during 2000, 2001, which are the tax years in question. Now, in the year 2000, Dr. Gagliardi decided to stop having his CPA, Mr. Goodman, do the bookkeeping at the year-end for his practices and rather engage the services of Carol Downey, a bookkeeper who had worked under contract with Mr. Goodman and who was recommended to Dr. Gagliardi by Mr. Goodman. Now, prior to that date, Mr. Goodman had handled the books as described by the court, and that said in this manner. After Dr. Gagliardi opened his first dental practice, Mr. Goodman performed bookkeeping services for Dr. Gagliardi's dental practices. Mr. Goodman was given business records from Dr. Gagliardi's dental practice, including the payroll books, check stubs, business bank account statements, and deposit tickets. And that was per the testimony of Dr. and Mrs. Gagliardi. After Dr. Gagliardi stopped using the services of Ms. Downey, Mr. Goodman again began handling the books for Dr. Gagliardi. For the 2 years in question, the court described Ms. Downey's work as follows. Ms. Downey has operated her own bookkeeping business since 1996 and was a subcontractor in Mr. Goodman's office when she began work for plaintiffs. She was responsible for what she termed bookkeeping for the three dental practices for the tax years in question. But she had no involvement in the plaintiff's personal finances, nor was she attempting to audit, review, or otherwise confirm the receipts or other documents she received captured all the business income. Now, and that said, she had testified she had no knowledge of revenue received by the dental practices because responsibilities did not include accounting for revenue from patients. Her role centered primarily on entering into the QuickBooks bookkeeping database the deposits made to business accounts, managing accounts payable for the practices by preparing the checks drawn on the business accounts in order to ensure that all the bills were paid, reconciling business bank accounts, and preparing reports from QuickBooks database to pass through to Mr. Goodman. The balance sheet, profit and loss statement, supporting documentation, including bank statements and credit card statements. The fact that Ms. Downey was not involved in the personal accounts and per engagement did not do any independent verification of items given to her would prove to create an issue. Because it turns out that Dr. and Mrs. Gagliardi didn't necessarily always deposit the cash from the dental practices in the business bank account. So the fact that she wasn't accounting for the completeness of revenue is an issue here because she didn't have all the revenue. Rather, it appears that our dentist and his wife thought that since it was all really their money to begin with, and since they needed spending money, they would take whatever spending money they might need to meet their living expenses, and rather than deposit that in the business account, then have to write a check out of the business account to their personal account for draw, we'd just shortcut that whole process, and we would take, whenever we needed the amount, a set of the checks from the business accounts, deposit into one of our personal accounts, and use that to pay personal bills. While the opinion doesn't explicitly say so, it appears they had done this in the past. But it appears that interpreting the events in a favorable light to the doctor, that Ms. Downey and Mr. Goodman may have each thought the other one was going to essentially take care of accounting for any amounts that didn't get deposited in the business account. Now, Mr. Goodman, the accountant and the CPA, explained what he did as follows. He said he did not perform bookkeeping on the plaintiffs during the 2000-2001 tax years. He relied on Ms. Downey to provide him with QuickBooks data to prepare the income report on the individual Schedule Cs and the expenses for each of the dental practices. He used both QuickBooks format for scheduling depreciation and Creative Solutions system software, another bookkeeping software package, to generate the information required for Schedule Cs. He did not verify the QuickBooks data were recorded properly. Now, Mr. Goodman took care of the tax filings, but it appears to presumed in doing the tax returns for the 2 years in question that the QuickBooks data had captured all of the receipts involved or all of the income for the dental practices. And that, as we note, is our problem because Dr. and Mrs. Gagliardi didn't see the need to put all their income into the dental practice. Now, Mrs. Gagliardi and Dr. Gagliardi's interaction with Mr. Goodman at the meeting to go over his tax information became a key issue in the case. And there was a difference in how the meeting was remembered by Mrs. Gagliardi and Mr. Goodman. Mrs. Gagliardi's recollection was described as followed by the court. Plaintiffs testified that during their annual meetings for the tax years in question, they provided Mr. Goodman with information about the deposits of business income they had made to all their personal accounts in the same manner that they had done in previous years. Mrs. Gagliardi stated that the plaintiffs commingled their business and personal accounts during 2001 and filed one return, so everything was one for us. Mrs. Gagliardi admitted that she had no written evidence that she had provided Mr. Goodman with information pertaining to deposits to the two Fleet bank accounts. Those were two personal accounts in this case. However, she was convincing that she compiled a list of deposits that she read off to Mr. Goodman. And opportune to that, we weren't taking a paycheck, so where else would I get the money to put into the account or the other account? During these two tax years, the plaintiffs obtained a loan from her father and reported rental income because the audit did not uncover any discrepancy that Mr. Goodman could not explain satisfactorily for these items. Now, note, interestingly enough, that the court accepted the fact that she orally told Mr. Goodman what the deposits were that were made to the personal accounts. There was no written documentation that she had given him that information. Now, that raises the question as to whether Mr. Goodman was actually paying much attention as she rattled off discussions about what she had given to the accounts. Mr. Goodman gave a somewhat different account of what he was told. He disclaimed knowledge of any deposits in the Kearney account until Ms. Weem brought the account to his attention. Mr. Goodman denied that Mrs. Gagliardi orally gave him the totals of business income deposited into personal accounts and denied that plaintiffs followed a practice of reporting additional business income in this fashion. So we have a difference here between Mr. Goodman and Mrs. Gagliardi, his client, about whether he had been told about these deposits and as well whether this had been the practice in the past. Faced with these differences of views, the court had to decide whose testimony to believe. And Mr. Goodman came out on the short end of that evaluation. The court noted, these key denials were not credible. The court found Mr. Goodman to be offhand. He had no records relating to information received in connection with his annual meeting with the plaintiffs. The memories of the principals, plaintiffs, and Mr. Goodman were captive to the brevity and informality of these encounters as well as their respective self-interests. Mrs. Gagliardi is not a fabricator. Dr. Gagliardi and Mr. Goodman are not records people. It's important to note here that the fact that the accountant didn't keep records and apparently had no memo of the meeting, no notations of any sort regarding what had gone on during the meeting with Dr. and Mrs. Gagliardi was, in this case, being held against him. It worked out for his client in this case. But obviously, if we were talking about a case where the doctor and Mrs. Gagliardi are bringing a claim against Mr. Goodman for the cost and expense of having to incur this trial, there is a real issue here with him for not having such records that could expose him to problems. The court did notice that Mr. Goodman had a potential problem since he had not questioned where the income numbers were complete and had eventually agreed to a fraud penalty on behalf of his clients. As well, given that Mr. Goodman was the accountant, the court's comment that he was not a records person, which may have been influenced by the lack of documentation, was hardly a ringing endorsement of the court's feeling for him as how he performed in this engagement. Now let's take a look at what the IRS found and the examination. The agent uncovered the following facts. The IRS established three bank accounts, or the plaintiffs established three bank accounts, we should say, the Gagliardi's, each corresponding to one of the three dental practices, the business bank accounts. The bulk of the income from each dental practice was deposited in the corresponding business bank account. In the course of the audit, Ms. Weem, who was the IRS agent, identified deposits of income from the dental practice made into three other bank accounts. A bank account with Fleet National Bank in the name of Dr. Gagliardi and his mother, the shared Fleet account. A bank account with Fleet National Bank in Mrs. Gagliardi's name, Mrs. Gagliardi's Fleet account, and a bank account with Kearney Federal Savings Bank in Dr. Gagliardi's name, the Kearney account. The income from the dental practice that was not reported in plaintiff's 2000-2001 tax return correlated with deposits of income from the dental practice into these three non-business accounts in 2000 and into the Kearney account in 2001. The shortfalls found were as follows. After an audit of the return for 2000-2001 that commenced on January 28, 2003, the IRS adjusted the amount of tax due by $17,917 for 2000 tax year and $5,740 for the 2001 tax year and imposed penalties for fraud in the amount of $13,437.75 for the 2000 tax year and $4,305 for the 2001 tax year. On July 14, 2004, Mr. Goodman signed a Form 870 consenting to the assessment of the tax, including the fraud penalty under Section 6663A, under the power of attorney he had to work with his client. The reason why Mr. Goodman consented to that penalty on behalf of his client, as he explained, it was noted by the tax court. This was Mr. Goodman's first experience representing client taxpayers who faced a civil fraud penalty. Mr. Goodman testified that he felt he had to acquiesce on the plaintiff's behalf in the fraud penalty because he could only refute the finding of fraud with great difficulty. Ms. Weem had mentioned to Mr. Goodman a possible criminal penalty in connection with the understatement of income. Mr. Goodman opined that he could have refuted the fraud penalty with a different IRS agent than Ms. Weem. Ms. Weem admitted on cross-examination that the IRS group coordinator who reviewed her audit results determined that the appropriate penalty would be civil and did not indicate that a criminal penalty would be considered. It appears that Mr. Goodman didn't have really an answer ready to go when the IRS agent proposed a civil fraud penalty. As we'll also discover, there may be reasons why the agent was not terribly happy at that point in time, felt the client had been non-cooperative, and the client may not have been the most cooperative with Mr. Goodman at the time either, so he may have felt that he was really in a bad position with an agent that was mad as a hornet, with a client that was not paying attention to what was going on, and the time running and the ability to get rid of this before a potential criminal indictment came down against the taxpayers. While the court notes that he felt he could only refute the penalty with great difficulty, it also noted that he seemed to believe that somehow this particular agent was his key point of difficulty. Very possibly because she was somewhat upset at this point with the taxpayer's lack of cooperation on a couple of issues regarding those outstanding bank accounts we'll discuss. The court also noted that the agent had mentioned a potential criminal penalty, which may have had an influence, let's be honest, on Mr. Goodman's thoughts about how to handle this, while the agent admitted that, in fact, eventually her superiors indicated no criminal penalty would be appropriate in this case. Now let's turn to the court's analysis. The IRS argued in court that six factors showed the taxpayers had engaged in conduct that justified the imposition of the fraud penalty. The court outlined the IRS's six badges of fraud as followed. Defendant argued the six such badges showed clearly and convincingly the plaintiffs had the requisite fraudulent intent. Concealment through understatement of income in multiple years, concealment of information from the accountant and bookkeeper, concealment of assets, inadequate records, failure to cooperate with the IRS, and implausible or inconsistent explanations of behavior. Defendant characterizes the badges of fraud in this case as manifest. Defendant's case, in brief, intended to adduce evidence that these six badges were present as a predicate for an inference of fraudulent intent. Now note, the IRS had claimed the fraud penalty here, which made the burden come initially on them to show that fraud had occurred. While presumptively all of the understatement is due to fraud once the IRS has shown fraud has occurred, the fraud penalty is one where the burden shifts to the IRS to show initially by the convincing evidence that, in fact, a fraud had taken place and that there was fraudulent intent behind this understatement. Now, the court deals with each of the six badges and why the IRS had failed to carry its burden. The court notes that if a taxpayer continuously understates his or her income over a number of years, that goes to indicate a fraudulent intent. One understatement could be an accidental oversight or have an innocent explanation, but for the accident to keep happening for a number of years without the taxpayer noticing this problem doesn't appear to be an accident. In the instant case, the court noted, the underreporting of income covered 2 years, tax years 2000-2001. It warrants mentions that these are the same 2 years that plaintiffs hired Ms. Downey and transferred bookkeeping responsibility for the three dental practices from Mr. Goodman's firm to Ms. Downey. According to the final form 4549 dated July 7, 2004, that Mr. Goodman signed on July 14, 2004, as plaintiff's representative during the IRS audit, the understatements of gross sales was $68,071 in 2000 and $40,621 in 2001. The total gross receipts reported by plaintiffs were $398,789 in 2000 and $817,551 in 2001. The percentage of gross receipts not reported was approximately 14.6% in 2000, 4.7% in 2001. Now, an interesting aside I would note about those numbers is note the rapid uptake in Dr. Gagliardi's practice for those 2 years. We don't have in front of us what his practice looked like in 1999, but clearly there's enough of a difference in those 2 years where you couldn't use 2000's collections to suggest what 2001 should have been. 2001's collections were over double what 2000's were, at least the reported amount was over double that amount. And the amount that was not recorded on the return, the $68,000, even if that's thrown into 2000, still doesn't make the two equivalent. Remember, we saw the $40,000 understatement in 2001. Rather, it appears there was no easy way by looking at gross receipts to have determined that, in fact, there must have been an understatement of income based on those totals. Now, the IRS attempted to cash the transaction as significant because of the higher percentage of understatement when you just looked at the individual schedule C's rather than the supplement income as a whole. The Gagliardis had reported this on the return on three separate schedule C's, and apparently one of them had been much more significantly impacted by the amount of income that had not been reported. But the court said that's irrelevant. We've got to look at the overall here. The court says the taxpayers have an option to report all such gross receipts and other business income on one Schedule C. Multiple Schedule Cs are not required. And that was by the testimony of the accountant. The plaintiffs filed individual Schedule Cs for each dental practice of no moment. Defendant argues the plaintiff should have been impressed with the magnitude of underreporting evidence on the Schedule C for the Union City practice. In 2000, plaintiffs reported gross receipts of $54,000 for Union City practice on Schedule C on their Form 1040. The IRS adjusted gross income by $68,000 to $122,143. In 2001, plaintiffs reported gross receipts of $58,000 for Union City practice on Schedule C. The IRS adjusted total gross receipts by $40,000 to $99,182. This assumes that plaintiffs reviewed not only their aggregate business income stated on the Form 1040 itself, but each optional Schedule C. For 2000 and 2001, the plaintiff's adjusted gross income was $46,947 and $15,920, respectively, against itemized deductions of $32,383 and $34,720. The discrepancy would not call out to the taxpayer's attention any underreporting. The IRS had concentrated that all of this tend to come from one Schedule C. The court said that wasn't relevant. The court said they didn't have any reason to report it that way. And presumptively, you would assume that if the taxpayer really was meaning to hide this, the way to have hidden this overall reporting and made it appear less significant would have been to report one total Schedule C, something which the taxpayer would have been allowed to do, as the tax court noted. There was no, now, as I should say, as the Court of Claims noted. There was no reason why the taxpayer had to file three Schedule Cs and essentially make this into something that became, to the agent, a big difference in the one Schedule C. The court found in the end neither number of years involved, which related only to 2 years from the bookkeepers involved, nor the amount, which the court found aggregate, wasn't high enough for it to be obvious to the taxpayers. So the court was not impressed with this, that this was a badge of fraud for having understated income consistently over multiple years. What about concealment of the income from the accountant and the bookkeeper? A taxpayer intent on committing fraud very well might hide his actions from other third parties, including the accountants and bookkeepers who are working on the project. Now, while it might be helpful to have them come along with you and help you hide the income, the bad news is in a criminal enterprise, and let's face it, fraud comes close to being a criminal type enterprise, that it's probably best not to have a whole bunch of people, all of whom know about this fraud and this crime going on. Any of them could become state's evidence, so we're just going to kind of hide it from those people. What they don't know, they can't tell the cops, right? Simple issue. So we may very well have hidden matters from our accountant and bookkeeper so they don't know about it. They're preparing the returns. There's no reason to bring them in on the fraud. So we just won't tell them about this information. The IRS argued that, in fact, they had concealed the existence of the deposits in the personal account from both the bookkeeper and the accountant. Now, as we noted earlier, the taxpayers contended they continued to provide information for about all accounts to Mr. Goodman as they had in the past. Everybody admitted that Ms. Downey was not providing any personal accounts. The court noted that the court finds, based on Ms. Downey's cogent testimony, that Ms. Downey had no role in the plaintiff's tax preparation, nor was she charged with any responsibility to record plaintiff's personal income or expenses. Ms. Downey's role is best characterized as a bookkeeper and manager of accounts payable for the three dental practices. It simply wasn't her job to do anything but deal with the three business accounts in front of her and get those into the QuickBooks database that she had. So the fact that they didn't tell her about those accounts was irrelevant because she wasn't supposed to be tracking that. She wasn't responsible for the tax return. But obviously, if the Gagliardis had also not told the accountant, shouldn't be surprising that the income didn't end up on the return. You don't tell anybody about the income, it won't end up there. So the key question is whether or not they informed Mr. Goodman. The court noted Mrs. Gagliardi was insisted that Mr. Goodman had to know she and her husband took no draws from the business bank accounts that would provide them income on which they could live. Now, that's an interesting argument because she's using here kind of a lifestyle argument to state that it should have been obvious to Mr. Goodman that since no draws were shown from these accounts, which he would have that information from QuickBooks, he should have asked the question, how did they live? And when answering the question, how did they live, he should have realized, you know, I bet there's other income of some sort or other money besides what's in those accounts. And at that point, should have compared that to what Mrs. Gagliardi told him about total deposits for the business and uncovered there's a discrepancy here. And that would have led, in theory, to the fact that we had understated income or that the business accounts did not have all of the deposits. Now, in this case, according to the plaintiffs, Mr. Goodman was not interested in retaining the checkbook registers. So basically, Mrs. Gagliardi testified that he was aware that they deposit business income directly into personal accounts because otherwise, according to Mrs. Gagliardi, I wouldn't be able to pay my mortgage. Now, Mr. Goodman didn't take the checkbook registers. Frankly, to me, that's not surprising. That's one of those issues during tax season. You're talking about a client who has a whole stack of junk in front of you, sometimes coming in with multiple boxes. That's always kind of fun when the clients come in with box after box. And they're shoving things across you. And at some point, they offered to give him the check register. Well, he sent it back to Mrs. Gagliardi. Obviously, that check register may or may not have had the evidence of the deposits directly in it. But remember, Mrs. Gagliardi testified she had told Mr. Goodman that she made deposits to the personal account. Mr. Goodman sidestepped any allusion of impropriety by saying that plaintiffs met with him in person only to give information concerning expenses and several other deductions related to the preparation of personal return. That may very well be true, to be honest. Mr. Goodman may have seen this meeting as, well, you know, they've moved the bookkeeping for the dental practices over to this other person. They're going to hand me this document. Often the case would be that happened because the client was complaining that Mr. Goodman charged too much and it was too expensive. And what could they do to cut the fees? And Mr. Goodman, of course, said, well, you could use this outside bookkeeper. She'll do the books and then they'll just hand me the information of the year and I'll put that on Schedule C and I won't be doing the books anymore. She's cheaper than me. I'm sure many of us have had that conversation with clients. This shows how it may come back to bite you. In this case, Mr. Goodman denied any knowledge of the Kearney account. The court found the plaintiff, especially Mrs. Gagliardi, testified more credibly as to what transpired at these meetings with Mr. Goodman. Now, Mrs. Gagliardi may very well have not understood the distinction when she outsourced, shall we say, the bookkeeping away from Mr. Goodman to the bookkeeper, the fact that there was a presumption being made by Mr. Goodman that the bookkeeper would be provided with all the deposits and or that all the deposits would go into the business bank account. The problem is that didn't happen, and Mrs. Gagliardi, believing that, in fact, what the bookkeeper was doing was more limited, did tell Mr. Goodman about the fact of how she'd made deposits. Mr. Goodman probably, honestly, at that point, may not have been interested in listening to it. I don't say not interested intentionally, but just more the idea, you know, they've complained about the fee. So, why, you know, I don't want to spend any time going back and reviewing this work because obviously, you know, their theory is that, you know, the fee is going to go down because I'm not doing the bookkeeping work. So I'm just going to accept the bookkeeping work. The court was also influenced by its understanding that Mr. Goodman was in a very precarious legal position now with his client in this situation, both in terms of whether he should have been aware the returns were prepared incorrectly and his later agreement to the assessment of the fraud penalty when he signed off on behalf of his client. I would note that in both of these cases, we don't have any discussion of what his engagement letter with the client said or if he had an engagement letter with the client. But clearly, it appears there wasn't a meeting of minds about what Mr. Goodman was doing and what his responsibilities were, at least in his mind versus the client's mind. And that was true both in the preparation of the return and it would appear later on in his representation in the audit, what he was supposed to do in certain situations. Similarly, the taxpayers had an interest in avoiding the civil fraud penalty. In both cases, these biases might influence the memories in crucial meetings with Mr. Goodman. The court noted, the court was at all times aware that Mr. Goodman had legal exposure to plaintiff's tax preparer and that plaintiffs had a vested interest in defeating fraud penalties. Plaintiffs on the one hand and Mr. Goodman on the other carefully avoided calling each other liars, and the key witnesses offered scenarios that were plausible. The court credits Mr. Goodman's testimony as far as he stated his purpose in the annual face-to-face meeting was obtaining information about the plaintiff's personal expenses and deductions. So the court agrees that most likely he saw that as the principal purpose of the meeting, not to go over and redo all the business books. The court credits plaintiffs insofar as they disclosed deposits orally and stood ready to give Mr. Goodman records of deposits to the personal accounts. Mr. Goodman was careful to minimize any oral disclosure by plaintiffs, and he portrayed their repertorial efforts as bumbling. Okay. While he disclaimed any intent by the plaintiffs to defraud, that is, he said, I don't think he intended to defraud anybody. He provided no safe harbor that either Dr. and Mrs. Gagliardi had disclosed the deposits of revenue from the dental practice into personal accounts, and he denied any knowledge of the Kearney's account existence until Ms. Weem informed him that she had uncovered it. Now, this is where the court had to decide between the two as to who they were going to believe. And what the court said here that was interesting was they found it plausible that both sides had produced plausible testimony and that both sides had produced a plausible scenario. The catch was these receipts were dropping through the cracks, and apparently it wasn't anybody intentionally was dropping them through the cracks. They were just dropping there. Faced with the conflict, the court concentrated on the taxpayers' claim they deposited the funds in personal accounts because that's what they lived off of. In essence, does that make sense? Rather than paying for such expenses out of the business accounts. Now, the court put a lot of weight on the fact there was no evidence that personal expenses had been paid out of any of the business accounts. That supports their theory they only deposited the funds they needed, essentially bypassing the business accounts likely because it made more sense to them than depositing the funds in the business checking account, only to later pull those funds right back out and put them in personal accounts. So only business expenses came out of the business checking accounts. They made no payments of personal expenses from there, and that's the kind of conversation an accountant might have with a client about, you know, to make this simple, make sure you only pay business expenses out of there, don't pay personal expenses. They may very well have innocently interpreted that to mean that, oh, well, we can't ever take funds out of that account for any other reason. And that means that when we need personal spending money, we're going to have to deposit funds into another account. And what do we have to deposit? The checks from the patients. Well, depositing to the account, though we know from an accounting standpoint, would clearly provide a better level of control. It would be much better for them to deposit all their receipts in the business accounts and then write a specific draw check over. It's also clearly understandable how that concept would never occur to somebody without formal accounting training. And they might not have any clue how that's going to cause income to be missed. Clients don't necessarily understand double entry accounting and double entry bookkeeping and the importance of capturing all data in the business accounting system. Rather, from their standpoint, there is this P&L that is totally divorced from a balance sheet. The two have nothing to do with each other. And what do you mean reconcile capital? That's where you get into trouble. And that's even more true if, as the evidence seems to suggest, they had done exactly the same in earlier years and Mr. Goodman had captured and reported that income himself. Now, there might be a question as to how he had captured and reported that income. It may very well be the taxpayers had merely given Mr. Goodman a summary of information. And, you know, for receipts, et cetera, may not have made much distinction. He may not have had anything to really build receipts from except what they told him the deposits were related to fees for the years and may have just been concerned with accounting for expenses. That is perfectly plausible for a messy set of books for that to have happened. So they decided in this case that, in fact, nothing had been hidden from either the bookkeeper or the accountant. That was not a badge of fraud. Similarly, The court then said, well, if they didn't hide that, they didn't conceal assets. The assets were out there in the open. Nobody was hiding anything from anything. In fact, there were amounts transferred from one of the concealed accounts in the business accounts that was picked up of income in the accounts of the business, labeled as funds accidentally deposited in the wrong account. Mr. Goodman noted, if there was fraud, why would they deposit the money back into the account and record as income? And the court found the IRS had no adequate response to Mr. Goodman's query on that point. That in fact, they weren't concealing, because if you're concealing that account, you certainly don't deposit money from that account back into the business account, because the IRS did find that transaction. The IRS next badge was a claim of maintenance of inadequate records as an attempt to conceal the fraud. The court note, defendant maintains that plaintiff failed to produce adequate records reflecting all their business income because they never advised Ms. Downing or Mr. Goodman that they had been depositing dental income into their personal accounts. However, the court notes, it already found that Mr. Goodman had been told about those deposits in those accounts. And as regard Ms. Downey, the court said the degree to which Ms. Downey was or was not informed of the plaintiff's personal finances is irrelevant unless she saw evidence that the plaintiffs were debiting the business bank accounts for any draws of personal expenses. So Ms. Downey had a requirement only to keep her eyes open that would have suggested to her there was a problem. But the fact that she didn't see a problem meant that she didn't have any responsibility to go out and look for it. And it did not appear to the court that taxpayers would attempt to actively hide things from her. They just didn't see why she needed to know. What about a failure to cooperate with the IRS? This was the one where the taxpayers nearly got themselves in trouble, but they were saved by, ironically enough, an action of Mr. Goodman, who did something that in the end was interpreted by the courts as showing sufficient cooperation to deny there was a fraud issue. A failure to cooperate with the IRS on examination is certainly something, though, you would expect of a taxpayer attempting to fraudulently avoid paying tax due. The court was heavily influenced by the fact that the taxpayers, Mr. Goodman actually in this case, had consented to an extension of the statute of limitations. Plaintiff's cooperation was evidenced by Mr. Goodman signing the Form 872, Consent to Extend the Time of Tax Year, for the year 2000, which authorized the IRS to continue assessing tax for the year 2000. Had plaintiffs not agreed to this extension, Ms. Weem opined that the statute of limitations likely would have run on the 2000 tax year during the course of the investigation. She was of the view the IRS would not have pursued investigation of tax year 2000 at all without first securing an extension. Now, this is the type of testimony that could cut against Mr. Goodman if the clients attempted to come after him in a claim of malpractice, because obviously the theory being that we didn't want to extend the statute, and the IRS now admits that we not extended the statute, the larger of the two assessments wouldn't have taken place. That could be a problem for Mr. Goodman there. But in this court, it worked to the advantage of the plaintiffs because it was an action that disadvantaged the plaintiffs and only advantaged the IRS, and the IRS benefited from that advantage. The court held there was cooperation. And that was enough for their issues. Now, other actions, though, argued against the theory they were cooperative, and this may very well explain why the fraud penalty came up. Honestly, in my case, I would believe this particular issue may very well have gotten the agent upset enough to consider the fraud issue from this point forward. And that was the problem, that they were uncooperative in providing access to the personal bank accounts. Now, if you remember the record, Mr. Goodman and the bookkeeper had access to all the business accounts, business records, business bank statements, etc. But they were never given the personal records. So the personal records would have been in control of Dr. and Mrs. Gagliardi. And in fact, the IRS requested on multiple occasions those records be provided, and they were not. Ultimately, they had to subpoena the records directly for this Fleet account, and then they had the accidental discovery of the Kearney account that they then had to also go after records for. However, ultimately, the court decided the overall actions didn't give the badge credence. It held the standard is not whether plaintiff gave an adequate cooperation, but whether they were uncooperative. Plaintiffs did cooperate by authorizing extension of the time to assess tax, thereby allowing the IRS to continue its investigation without making inordinate demands of Ms. Weem. Given the totality of the circumstance, the courts cannot say the defendant proved the plaintiffs were uncooperative with the IRS, at least not uncooperative enough to show a badge of fraud. Now, on implausible, inconsistent explanation, the court found that taxpayers had clearly not kept the best set of records, but noted that the IRS hadn't assessed a negligence penalty. Now, a negligence penalty is one, honestly, in these facts, that the IRS would have had on a slam dunk. It's tough to say there wasn't some real negligence here with how the records were being maintained. But the opinion notes that the court is convinced that at worst, plaintiffs exhibited benign ineptitude in arranging their financial and tax affairs. I would say that's probably a pretty good description. Ineptitude covers it pretty well. You don't have to worry about criminal intent where just simple incompetence will cover it. The court went on to note that the taxpayers did not have adequate controls in place, that Mr. Goodman had not advised them to do so, but in one of the few times the court seems to give a sympathetic phrase to Mr. Goodman, noted that he was never actually asked to provide such information to the taxpayers either. So taxpayers had never asked, how should we record the books? Mr. Goodman had never suggested how they should record the books. And therefore, they kept a set of books that honestly were horrendous, and they had systems and procedures that were horrendous and that were pretty much guaranteed to fail. But that wasn't because they were trying to hide income. It's simply because they didn't know what they were doing. Ultimately, the court found the following the most plausible explanation for the activities. That said, based on the record, the court finds it plausible and consistent that during the transition between having Mr. Goodman's firms handle bookkeeping for the dental practices and Ms. Downey's transfers to Dr. Gagliardi's dental office in the same building, some miscommunication and misunderstanding occurred as to who had responsibility for capturing all the plaintiff's business income. Both Mr. Goodman and Ms. Downey believably were skeptical the plaintiffs could summon the required mindset to evade taxes. One uncontroverted piece of evidence dispelling intent to defraud was Dr. Gagliardi's redeposit business income from the Kearney account to a business account. Notice, the accidental foul-up where they deposited a check in Kearney that they meant to deposit in the business account turned out to be an important piece of evidence that the court held in their favor. So again, like the extension of the statute, which might be considered to be a screw-up because it got the bigger assessment and the IRS otherwise could not have assessed that year, because of this screw-up of fouling up their deposit, they also lost a badge of fraud. In essence, they were proving maybe they weren't the most competent people, but their actions to correct errors were the type of actions you wouldn't have taken if you were trying to defraud. Now, what about the accountant's representation? Mr. Goodman's representation was a matter of dispute even in this case. The taxpayers attempted to argue that he had exceeded his authority in agreeing to the penalty and that the taxpayer shouldn't be held accountable for his actions in agreeing to the penalty. However, at this point, the court failed to remain sympathetic towards the taxpayers as it had been before. The court noted items suggested the taxpayers had been extremely nonchalant about keeping up with the examination. For instance, forwarding letters from the IRS during the exam to the accountant that were unopened, even though he was getting copies of everything. Just they got some from the IRS, they just took the sealed envelope and sent it straight to the CPA. Unfortunately, I think as we're all aware, we all have clients who would do things like that. And they're not necessarily the easiest clients to get information from, sometimes not because they're intentionally defrauding, but simply because they've decided that that's not their problem. They ignore that. You take care of that. That may have very well been the issue that happened here. For instance, there's the issue of getting those personal bank account records. The court notes the situation as follows. One strong indication plaintiffs were uncooperative was their unexplained and unjustified delay in producing records for the Kearney and the two personal First Fleet bank accounts in response to Ms. Weems' serial information document requests. They did not deflect the fact by ignoring certified mailings of each notice that Ms. Weems sent to each plaintiffs, copied to Mr. Goodman. Nor did plaintiffs absolve themselves from knowledge Ms. Weem had to make repeated requests for information just because they turned over these letters unopened to Mr. Goodman. They were getting multiple certified letters from the IRS, and they just simply handed them over to the accountant, never opened them to figure out what was happening. Ultimately, Ms. Weem was required to subpoena the bank account records for the known bank accounts, the two Fleet bank accounts. The Kearney account was brought to her attention only due to Dr. Gagliardi's redeposit and business bank account of a check drawn from the Kearney account. While we don't know for sure why those records could not be produced, it seems very possible that Mr. Goodman may have been unable to get the taxpayers to pay much more attention to his own request for information than the IRS was getting to letters it was sending, letters that, as we noted, were going unopened, then be forwarded directly to Mr. Goodman. Note, the items that weren't any problem and that the IRS got right away were the items that had already been provided to the bookkeeper and Mr. Goodman before the exam started. It seems very possible that the taxpayers may simply have decided, well, this is an examination. We've already got paid for the tax work. We've already have tax work done. He's taking care of it. We signed a power of attorney. We're just not going to pay any attention. We can't be bothered with this. We have other things to do. The court also lectured the taxpayers that they had given Mr. Goodman a power of attorney to act on their behalf, and his actions did not go outside that authorization despite their now buyer's remorse later at his actions in agreeing to the fraud penalty. Plaintiffs represented the argument that both at trial and in the pretrial brief, Mr. Goodman exceeded the scope of his authority by agreeing to the fraud penalty, particularly by doing so when he was instructed to delay any such final resolution of the audit during the plaintiff's trip to Italy. Apparently, the taxpayers have said, we're going on vacation to Italy, and you just need to stall the IRS then and don't get, you know, and wait till we get back before we'll finalize anything. This is at the time when a civil fraud penalty is going to be proposed, and the IRS agent is suggesting that maybe this could go criminal. Interesting time to take your vacation to Italy and not return phone calls, apparently. Plaintiffs spent a not insignificant amount of their cross-examination attempting to render this point significant. Their argument is unavailing because Mr. Goodman had a valid power of attorney through two Form 2848 executed by plaintiffs for years 2000-2001. Form 2848 authorized Mr. Goodman to serve as plaintiff's representative for all matters before the IRS pertaining both to the filing of each tax return and to the audit period. Mr. Goodman accepted the fraud penalty on behalf of plaintiffs by executing on July 14, 2004, a Form 870 waiver restrictions of assessment, collection of deficiency in tax, and acceptance of overassessment. The Form 870, by its own term, expressly reserved plaintiffs' rights to pursue this refund action. However, the court did note that Mr. Goodman's choice of how to inform the clients that he had accepted a fraud penalty was a somewhat strange way of doing so. The opinion notes, Mr. Goodman was less than forthcoming about the assessment of the fraud penalty and his acceptance of that assessment. Plaintiffs maintained they were totally ignorant during the course of the audit, including the assessment of a fraud penalty. Well, not opening letters suggests that their ignorance wasn't just because somebody was hiding stuff from them. They were just remaining intentionally ignorant. Plaintiff cannot escape the responsibility by apprising themselves of the nature of the audit because Ms. Weems sent each of them by certified mail all of her information document requests and other written correspondence pertaining to the audit. Mr. Goodman first informed plaintiffs that he was executing the Form 870 agreeing to the fraud penalty sometime after July 7, 2004, when Ms. Weems gave Mr. Goodman the Form 870, and before July 14, 2004, when the Form 870 was actually executed. Goodman's own discomfort with explaining the fraud penalty to plaintiff was evidenced from the setting in which he did so. The conversation took place in the parking lot outside his office building, which he shared with one Dr. Gagliardi's practice, and Mrs. Gagliardi credibly testified as both her shock and dismay with Mr. Goodman's abruptness on that vacation. However questionable Mr. Goodman's choice of venue might have been, plaintiff's argument that Mr. Goodman exceeded his scope of authority are immaterial in the light of the Form 2848, which executed Mr. Goodman to serve as plaintiff's representatives for all matters pertaining to the audit period. Now, the parking lot conversation obviously is an interesting place to tell somebody that, oh, yeah, I'm going to agree to a fraud penalty on your behalf. But note, it did take place. He did notify them of this before the date in question. And it may very well have been that catching her in the parking lot was the only way he was getting attention, because as far as they were concerned, he was to somehow magically delay this whole thing until after they got back from Italy. We don't know why, but that's how the notice got given. And more interestingly, it doesn't appear that they ever suggested to him that he should not sign that form. What's more interesting and concerning to me is the fact that he executed the form, and the question would arise, especially if any complaint comes against him on this, if they try to take a claim for any civil case against him, Mr. Goodman, would be, did he in fact ask them to execute this document or agree to other options, and were they again ignoring everything so that by July 14th he felt that he had to sign this document, or the whole thing could really spin out of control and could even come down to criminal indictment of them. Now, that's a potential problem if that was his justification, because Mr. Goodman was not an attorney. No one ever suggested he was. And honestly, my own gut reaction is once we start talking, the minute we start saying the word criminal and involved in examination, it's the time we need somebody who has actual privilege in criminal matters to be involved in the exam. It's time to bring the attorney into the fold. Now, maybe Mr. Goodman tried to do that. Maybe when he tried to do that, he didn't get any response from his client again. But at that point, I think in my case, I would have to seriously consider telling the client, either you talk to me and we get an attorney in, or I'm resigning, because this is going out of control and you need to realize it's serious. Of course, many of us might question why he agreed so quickly at the exam level to the fraud penalty. But again, remember what we had discussed earlier. This was his first encounter with that, and he had the threat of the criminal indictment. Now, the explanation that we have of that suggests a number of possible reasons why he conceded the point, all of which are clearly speculation at this point. We know none of which are correct, and obviously we can't know that, but let's consider them because they are the sort of things that could arise. We need to be worried about them if we're representing a client. It is possible that he had taken on an engagement for which the accountant had taken on an engagement for which he did not have adequate experience or expertise. Notice, doing that violates the code of professional ethics for a CPA. That's a potential problem before we ever get started. It's also probably not a good idea if it's shown and there's a civil case raised against you. He may not, though, have had the knowledge base to realize just how weak the IRS position was going to be on attempting to get a civil fraud penalty, and have been far too quick to concede the issue at the very lowest level. Note, we're not even talking about conceding this at appeals. We're conceding it at the agent level. Secondly, maybe the accountant allowed himself to be intimidated by the IRS suggestion of criminal prosecution of the taxpayer, or his own concern that he might be subjected to disciplinary proceedings if he gave any credence to the idea of the taxpayers that may have he believed disclosed all the information to him. That is a potential issue. Again, the threat of criminal prosecution is obviously one that is scary, but it is one that those of us who are not attorneys need to understand that since we don't have privilege, if in fact the IRS even suggests at all or the case appears to be drifting in a direction that could lead to a criminal issue arising, it's time to get someone with privilege in the door. Presumably an attorney who would have had some experience in these matters, a tax attorney with experience in this area, may very well have been able to deflect the agent, may very well have been able to wake up the client. It appears that Mr. Goodman was having trouble doing that, perhaps due to his longtime friendship with the client that caused him problems relating, but something needed to happen. If Mr. Goodman was truly scared by the criminal intent, then that's a problem. As an accountant, again, criminal, not my area. And when that comes up, I really think those of us who are not attorneys need to seriously consider the need to get legal counsel in now to both determine how valid the claim of criminal intent might be and to protect the client in case the case does go criminal. Now, another suggestion from what I discussed above is that maybe the accountant became aware of a potential conflict of interest between his interest in fully representing the clients in the exam and defending his prior professional work preparing the return, either from the IRS or the client in the later claim. That is, a representative who had not been involved in the preparation of the return might have been far more apt to advance more strongly the claim that everything had been disclosed to the accountant who prepared the return in defending the client against an IRS claim that we're going to assess a civil fraud penalty. You know, if I wasn't involved in preparing the return, and the client is telling me that they told the accountant everything, that I'm probably going to push the agent pretty hard on that point. But since Mr. Goodman was the individual who had supposedly been told, and he now has a bit of a problem. If he says, oh yes, I was told, but I just didn't do anything with it, he has to worry both about a potential liability to his client for having been so poor at preparing the return. And he has to worry about a potential problem with the IRS, perhaps a referral to the Office of Professional Responsibility or a preparer penalty being assessed because he had prepared a return that he should have known was in error. So it was against his interest to have any recollection or make any statement that the client believed they had given him the information. In essence, the client needed him to, as a representative, he would have to fall on his sword. That's a conflict that can arise in a case like this where you're representing a client where you prepared the return. That said, the side effect of it, though, is that obviously the person who was involved in preparation of the return is generally in the best position to understand what happens, knows the facts best, and bringing in an independent representative is probably going to be a much more expensive proposition to handle the examination. The hitch here is you won't really know there's this conflict until we get far into the exam and the issue arises and now we have an issue. Mr. Goodman wasn't aware of the understatement, which I think is a plausible explanation that he wasn't aware it hadn't been stated. Now, so he walked into an exam, thought there was no problem. Suddenly the problem arises and now he's stuck. Interestingly enough, it appears the problem was noticed because of that deposit over in the Kearney account, led to that account suddenly indicating that other checks had been deposited. Then that rolled back into 2000, which brought up the whole issue that these were the personal accounts that also had deposits of business accounts in them. And there's certainly a strong suggestion with the facts in the case that the client may have just been a difficult client to work with during the exam. One reason why the accountant may have felt he couldn't argue against a fraud penalty was because the clients weren't cooperating to give him any information to help him argue against that penalty. They were ignoring correspondence from the IRS. If they were ignoring correspondence from him as well, the accountant was stuck between a rock and a hard place. It's difficult to refute the fraud penalty if the party who supposedly wanted to defraud the IRS won't give you information about what they did, or at least isn't responding to that. As well, the client's theory that because they want to take their trip to Italy and we should stall all this till after everything was done, which the court doesn't say, but may very well have been Mrs. Gagliardi's response when he informed them in the parking lot that, in essence, you know, the fraud penalty is being proposed and he was going to agree to it. If that was in fact her response, and we suspect the agent may not have been too thrilled with the theory that, well, we don't want to sign this till they get back, that could have been a major problem and why he felt that he just had a wholly uncooperative client and he tried to make the best of a bad situation. However, in the end, the Court of Claims found the penalty was not justified. But that was only after the taxpayers had to incur the expense of going to the court and filing this claim, an expense which honestly, at the amount of penalty involved, $17,000, it may very well have cost them nearly as much in legal fees and other expenses to litigate this claim and get the penalty back as the penalty itself was. This became a very expensive undertaking, and why this whole thing came apart, not clear, but it's clear that there seems to be a lot of potential issues and problems with how everyone, client, accountant, and the IRS handled themselves in this case, and ultimately the Court of Appeals found that what should have happened was simply the assessment of tax and probably a negligence penalty. But since the IRS hadn't gone for a negligence penalty, the Court of Claims says, sorry, you're just out of luck there. Now, this has been the tax update for June the 2nd, 2008. As I note, I've been in New Orleans this week, so this is being posted somewhat after being recorded. The tax update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them and consider subscribing to their newsletters for tax-related matters of interest to those in tax practice. This has been the tax update.